exposing ourselves and our problems, that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, our speaker is Dee from Culpeper.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dee, and I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs.
Hey.
And the last time I was here, I was really, really nervous. I'm not as nervous this time. I have to say that to myself. Okay, so my sobriety date is August the 7th, 2007. And this isn't my first time in AA. My first time was in 1990. And I was having problems on my job. I was having problems financially. I was having problems raising my son. I come from a family of addicts and alcoholics, but my father nor my mother drank or did drugs. I'm the oldest of three on my mother's side and the oldest of two on my father's side. I remember I found out one time I found out what a bastard was. And when I found out what a bastard was, I knew that was me. They told me that a bastard is a person whose mother and father didn't get together, weren't married. So I'm the oldest of both sets of my siblings. And I think that I always knew my dad. He was always a part of my life. And, of course, I lived with my mom, but I never, ever felt complete. I never felt a part of. I would go stay with my dad when my mother couldn't deal with me anymore, and I felt out of place there because I didn't have my father's last name, and I never felt complete living with my mother because all of my siblings and their last name was the same. My mother gave me her maiden name. And so I grew up in Southeast D.C. Originally, we lived in California. We moved to D.C., and I started school. We lived in a good neighborhood. Most people don't think of Southeast Washington, D.C. as a good neighborhood, but back in the 60s, it was a decent neighborhood. We had grass and everything. I went to Moton Elementary School, and I graduated to go to junior high school. They didn't have middle school back then. And my mother, she decided, because all of my friends were going to go to Douglas Junior High, that she would send me to a school across Suitland Parkway. And she wanted, because at that point in time, I had started getting into trouble. If my mother said, go right, I would go left. If she said, go up, I would go down. I always thought that she was mean, but she was just a strong disciplinarian person. And I have always had problems with people disciplining me. You know, I don't know why, and I still don't know why today. So I went to Northern Junior High School, and it was right across the street from the projects. Back then, I was a cute little girl, and I had cute little pigtails, and we couldn't wear jeans. We wore dresses, and the little girls that lived across the street knew that I was new in the school. So they proceeded to tell me, you know, I was going to give them my money, my lunch money, and I was going to do what they told me to do. Well, they didn't know I was an angry little girl. They just didn't know that. I might have looked good on the outside, but on the inside, I was mad. I was mad because my mother and father weren't together. I was mad because I was a bastard child. I was mad because, you know, things didn't fit the way I thought they were supposed to fit. And so I was always in trouble. I had to fight my way through school, you know, because nobody was going to take anything from D. I met this little boy. At this time, I was probably 13 years old, 12 or 13, and he became my boyfriend. And one day, we decided we was going to hook school. So we hooked school, and does anybody remember Roberta Flack killing me softly with his song? Mm-hmm. That was playing on the radio, and I gave up my virginity. I did it one time. And the first time, I got pregnant. I didn't know. I didn't have any big sisters. I didn't have nobody to talk to. My mother was not the kind of person that, you know, talked to you or anything like that. And so we proceeded to have a little relationship. I think he was like 14. I'm 13. during that time, I started hooking school a lot. I was running away from home because my mother wanted me to do what she asked me to do, and I didn't want to do it. I remember my mother asked me to do a couple of things. Because I was the oldest, I was to pick my little sisters and brothers up, bring them home, go in the house, lock the door, and don't answer the door. I had to cook, clean the whole nine yards. And in my mind, I didn't appreciate it because I wanted to play with my friends. I wanted to be a cheerleader. I wanted to do after-school activities. And I felt like she was making me be responsible for her children and not, you know, it wasn't my responsibility. I don't feel that way today, but that's the way I felt at the time. So I proceeded to go home one day, put my siblings in the house, told them don't answer the door. And so I heard somebody say, and everybody called me Deanna. That's my name, Deanna. And everybody was outside saying, Deanna, your mother is looking for you. I decided that day that she was not going to beat me again because my mother, she definitely believed in beating, and wherever she felt like. And I said, I'm not going to do it today. So that night, I decided to run away from home. Little did I know, the next day, I decided, okay, I'm going to go home. Me and my friends, we're going to go home. I'm going to get my clothes, and because one of my little friends' mother said I could stay at their house. And so I went home. I decided I'm going to cook some breakfast and pack my clothes, and I'm going to leave. Little did I know, my mother was at the neighbor's house looking out the window. She waited right good until we got in the house. And she came in. She put everybody out. She dragged me to the car. And she took me downtown on Martin Luther King Avenue at the precinct. And she was proceeding to put me away. And I remember standing in front of the judge and him asking me, what do I have to say for myself? I said, my mother beats me with extension cords. And I decided I wasn't going to get beat again. And he proceeded to look at me in my eyes and say, if you were my daughter, I would beat you with extension cords too. And that night, I was put away in a girl's shelter. Little did she know and little did I know, I was pregnant. So I lived in this place up in Northwest D.C., 14th and U. I know y'all probably heard of that place. And I had to get up every day and drive and ride the bus all the way to school and leave school and come all the way back. I don't know how long I was there, but I remember it was around, Easter, somewhere around that time I was released. But at that time, she didn't realize I was pregnant. So I was too far gone to do anything about it. And I went back home and I started doing the same thing I did before I left, just doing what D wanted to do. I just wouldn't obey her, no kind of way. So I left again and went to stay with my friend. And slowly but surely, we got back together, and I started going to the house, visiting my mother, visiting my siblings, and taking them places and things like that. And December 1973, and don't be trying to guess my age, 1973, I proceeded to have my son. About 6 months later, I went to Baltimore. And I stayed there for a while, and then my father came and picked me up. My father lived in Baltimore, but I didn't want to go to his house because he was going to discipline me like my mother disciplined me. At this point, it wasn't too much they could do with me. But he came over one day, and he said, "Dee, you're going to go to school, and you're going to take care of this child." And I remember my dad talking to me, and he said, "You know, everybody's entitled to have a mistake." He said, "But if you get pregnant again, it's not a mistake." So anyway, I moved in with my dad. They put me back in school. I completed the eighth grade. And I came back home one day to my dad's, and I packed my stuff up, and I went back to my grandmother's because, again, he had rules and regulations. And, you know, looking at it now, I know that, you know, my grandmother, she wasn't as strong a disciplinarian as my parents were, but I always felt like my grandmother truly loved me. I mean, she had that unconditional love that I had been seeking. I just always felt like my mother was too strict. And she just didn't allow me to do the things that my friends' parents let them do. She didn't let us go shopping. Like, I would babysit, and she would take the money, and she would say, "You know, how do you think you eat every day? How do you think you got a roof over top of yourself, you know, a roof over top of your head? Can we have a dog? No. I can't afford to feed a dog." And don't get me wrong, we lived in a nice house. I mean, we lived in an apartment, but we had nice things, you know, but she just... She was just strong. She didn't trust me. You know, I see it today. You give me an inch and I'm going to take a yard. And I always, hate is a strong word, but I really didn't like my mother. I really didn't. And I liked my dad, but he had a wife. And she didn't like me either. You know, looking back on it now, I don't think it's that they didn't like me. They just didn't know how to deal with me because I was a hot mess. And I have to take responsibility for that. And I didn't really see that in myself until I did that fourth and fifth step. But that's another story. So anyway, first time I took a drink, I was 13 years old and I had a blackout. I drank some White Lightning. Glass about this tall, about that much, and I remember bragging about it, like, you know how you being around your friends and you trying to show off, knowing you ain't never done it, but I was like, "Oh, I can drink this straight," and I did, and the glass dropped to the floor, and that's all I remember. And you know, other things were introduced into my drinking, but that's all I wanted to do. I've heard other people describe the first time they did it, they decided that's what they want to do for the rest. That's not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. But it was the people that I was hanging around with. Because I really didn't enjoy drinking alcohol. I just liked what it did to me, you know, when I didn't black out. But I never not blacked out because every time I drank to oblivion. When I did anything, I did it to oblivion. I mean, who's going to just do a little bit? You know, I always wanted to do all of it, and I never seemed to get as much as I wanted, you know. Moving on up, like I said, I dropped out of school at the age of 8th grade. I don't know how old I was, 15, 16. When I started school, I was a year behind because of California. They put me back into what they call junior primary, so I was already a year behind. And then I took a year off when I had the baby, and then my father put me back in school, so I'm 2 years behind already. And I was so ashamed of the fact that I had a baby at 13. I used to put 3 years on my age because of the shame of having a baby. But anyway, I moved back to my grandmother's, and, of course, it got worse. I always liked partying. I always liked bright lights. Always liked music. And I always liked boys, period. That's what I liked. And I just never really felt worthy of anything other than that, you know. Again, I don't really know why, but I just did. I always needed somebody to make me feel good about me. I needed somebody to tell me that I was better than what I thought I was. And I always liked older guys. So I dated a lot of guys. I had my son. I got introduced to other things. And like I said, I did everything to oblivion. So I didn't go back to school. I know that I tried to complete school a few times, but every time it got in the way of getting high, partying. If it got hard, I would quit. I probably did that like 2-3 times, but I always worked. I met this guy, and probably about a month or so later, we started living together. I didn't know then what I know now, but he was an alcoholic, and he was a mean alcoholic. And one day, he punched me. And I stayed in that relationship for about 3 years. He literally beat me every time he got drunk. I remember one day my father came over to the house because my sister came over. This was before cell phones. We didn't have a house phone. And my sister came over to see me one day, and I had a black eye. And she went home, and she told my dad. And one day the doorbell rang, and it was my dad. And he said, "Get your stuff." But he didn't say stuff, but I can't cuss, so, you know. He said, "Get your stuff. You're leaving." And he took me back to his house. And I still was doing my thing, partying, everything, just all over the place. But I stayed with him for a while until I got my own place. Still partying, drinking. And it wasn't until I got introduced to another, I don't know, can I say drug? It was a drug. That's when things really went downhill for me. I always had alcohol there, but I also always had other things there because I got to the point that I felt like I couldn't really control my alcohol consumption because every time I drank, I blacked out. So I was thinking, you know, well, maybe I'll try something else. And so I did. And that's when things really went downhill for me. I started doing that. I was working. At this point, I'm back in Maryland. I'm working for DC Public Schools. I can't go to work every day because of this other thing that I'm doing. And, you know, I'm going to work. I'm sleeping on the floor. I'm sleeping under the desks. I get a check. It's 68 cents because I don't have any leave. And I remember my brother coming to me one day. And let me say this. I never heard of AA. Never. Nobody in any of my talks, people I met, I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never heard of NA either. You know, I knew something was wrong with me, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know how to fix it. I did a lot of praying, but to no avail. I remember one time I went and got baptized thinking that that would help me. But, of course, I came home, somebody knocked on the door, and I'm back to the races. That's pretty much how it went for years. Like I said, I got that check for 68 cents. I lost my place. My son was in trouble with the law. And I remember my brother, he's deceased now. I remember one day he came and he was down on his knees and he was crying and he said, "Dee, please get you some help." And I, like I said, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anybody like me, but I knew people like me, but I didn't know how they felt on the inside. You know what I'm saying? So what ended up happening is I was introduced to employee assistance program. I got a counselor, and that's when I found out about AA. I remember wanting to go to rehab, and she said my insurance wouldn't cover it. So she said I had to do outpatient. So that's how I ended up in AA. I remember her telling me, well, she gave me this sheet, that sheet that people sign when they have to go to meetings and get it signed. She gave me one of those, and she gave me a where and when, and she told me I had to do these meetings. And I was totally pissed off because I didn't understand what AA was going to do for me. A piece of paper and go here. And I remember saying to her, "What's going to happen if I don't go?" And she said, "Well, then you're going to have wasted my time. And you will have wasted your time." So I snatched everything out of her hand because I knew that this is my only way to get help that I thought I couldn't get. And so that's how I got introduced to AA. Really the other program first, to be honest with you, because that's where the glaring problem was. And I remember going there and just thinking to myself, I don't know how this is going to help me. I don't know how this is going to work. But because I had that stupid paper that I had to get signed, I had to go. I guess I didn't have the mindset, well, I could just get somebody else to sign it. I didn't think that far. I just went and had to get this sheet signed. I thank God today, you know, that I did. So that's how I was introduced to the other program. And then one day I went to the other program. I thought I was going to the other program. And it was this guy standing at the door. His name is Kenny G. I'll never forget it. He was an older guy. I had been going to the other program for a while. I don't know how long. Wasn't a year because I hadn't celebrated a year, but it was a while. And I remember him just saying, "Welcome. You're in the right place." And I just remember a feeling went over me that I had never felt before. And that meeting, it was in Glen Arden, Maryland. The name of that group was Handshakes and Hugs, and that became my home group. I don't even know if I had a home group in the other one. I just remember this is where things started making sense to me. This is where I felt like I really belonged, and this is where, you know, I felt the love in the rooms. This is where, you know, I met my husband too. Well, he was a guy then, but and so I had tried to get a sponsor in the other I just couldn't. It just didn't work out for me. I'm not putting nobody down, nothing down, but for me, it was AA. That's where the substance was. That's where, you know, I got a sponsor. That's where, you know, I started working the steps. That's where I celebrated my first year anniversary. I remember my sponsor, we talking back in 1990. So that's been some years ago. I was a little younger back then, and I dressed a little different back then. And I remember one day she said, D, she said, D. I don't know. They started calling me D when I started working. That's when my name changed from Deanna to D. And she said, the clothes you are wearing is not appropriate. Of course, you know, I was young, low cut, see-through. I was looking good. And when she told me that, I didn't say it to her, but in my mind, I was thinking, oh, she fat, she old, and she jealous. That's what I was thinking. I was like, she's just jealous because I look better than her. So I didn't really pay her no attention. I stopped calling her. I got a new sponsor. She fired me because of Chuck. She didn't think I was, you know, working the steps, and she didn't think I was, you know, no relationships for the first year, and you know, and I shouldn't be doing this, and I took all of that as people trying to tell me what to do. It was my perspective. I see that clearly now, but you couldn't have told me that then. These people, I done just got out of that relationship with my mother trying to tell me what to do. People been trying to tell me what to do all my life, and I just wasn't going to hear it. I had my first year anniversary. Everybody had to wear black and white. I had black and white pictures, black and white clothes on. I mean, I made my first anniversary a big deal. And everybody kept telling me, D, it's not a big deal. I was like, well, it's because it just ain't your first year anniversary. They don't understand. I've been drinking and drugging all my life. This is a big deal. So I proceeded to do it my way. I did get my GED. I remember putting it in a frame and bringing it to the AA meeting so y'all can see it. See? So even then, I was still a hot mess. And I really didn't do the steps. I never went to Big Book meetings. You go to Big Book meetings, don't you have to know about the Big Book? So I never went to those meetings. I always went to open discussion. Like I said, I had a sponsor, but I never used it. One sponsor fired me. Another one, I just stopped calling. And anyway, I got a year in the program, so now I can date officially. So I had my eyes on him. I'm telling y'all the truth. That's where I was at. And actually, it worked out pretty good because we're still together. That's been 28 years ago. I've been married 28 years. But we went on the cruise. Let me say, I went to meetings for 5 years, but that's all I did is go to meetings. I did not work the steps of this program. I didn't think they were necessary. I had 5 years. What's the point? I got married. I had 2 years in the program. Chuck had more time than me. We got married. It was a dream come true because I couldn't believe that somebody wanted me. We moved. And this is the other problem. Got down there in Virginia. We lived in Temple Hills, Maryland. That's where I got sober. And we moved down to Sterling, Virginia. And like I said, I had 5 years. Well, I had completed. I had picked up my 5-year chip while I was still living in Sterling. I had gone to the meetings. I don't know. I can't tell Chuck's story, but I'll tell you this. I went to meetings because I knew that the meetings had kept me sober. And I tried to get in the middle of it like I did in Maryland, but it just was not the same. And to this day, I mean, I know I did it, but I didn't know I was doing it when I was doing it. But I did identify it out. And the reason I identified out, because everybody that was at these meetings in Sterling looked like y'all except for Chuck and Thurston, the guy sitting next to Thurston, David, and me. They didn't look like us. They looked like y'all. And that's okay, you know, because I wasn't raised prejudiced or anything. My mother always taught us to treat people how you want to be treated. But they was not the same as the people I got sober with. They didn't talk the same. They didn't look the same. You know, I was used to people coming up to me, well, not coming up to me, but sharing from the podium, my name is Ethel C., and I'm a dope fiend in an AA meeting. I was used to people like Bill, who lived in the dump, and he was saying dirty, nasty, low down. I mean, they talked about stuff that I had never experienced and I didn't want to experience. And that in itself kept me sober for those 5 years. But when I started going to meetings in Sterling, it was like Mary Lou sitting at the table knitting, talking about my cat died and I took a glass of wine. And, you know, I just couldn't relate, man. I couldn't. I was like, that ain't what I'm used to hearing. And I don't know. One day I didn't go to a meeting and nothing happened. And that went on for 10 years. I just stopped going to meetings. At that point in time, I wasn't hanging around with those old people, places, and things. You know, I didn't know where the stuff was at. You know, and I liked, you know, the fact that I wasn't drinking or doing any drugs. But looking back on it now, I was so miserable. I was still a liar, cheat, and a thief. I was still angry, you know. And just back up a little bit. My first year in recovery, I lost my only son, the son that I had when I was 13. I lost him to this disease. Thank God for AA. Because I probably would have killed myself if it hadn't been for the people in the rooms, you know. So I had that on my plate when I came back in. Make a long story short, I thought we had arrived, you know. Chuck and I did pretty good. You know, I got a good job. He was still working for his company. You know, we bought a house. I had a garage with a garage door opener. Click, click. You know, I was driving my Infiniti up in there. You know, I had every credit card. You know, I thought my life was good. I really did. I thought it was good. And, you know, we got some investment properties. I mean, just all the material things that can happen when you're doing the right thing and you're putting your money in the right places. And we went on this cruise. That's where the trouble began. Well, the trouble began a long time ago, but that's when it came to a head. I've since heard that they have AA meetings on a cruise. I ain't know that then. But we had long stopped going to meetings, so that wasn't anything that we were thinking about. We had met this couple on the cruise. They was on their honeymoon. They had some marijuana. They was having a party on the cruise. Now, mind you, I went on this cruise with my father, his wife, my sister, her husband. She had just got married, and my brother and his girlfriend. We did a family cruise. Me and Chuck on the cruise, getting drunk and smoking weed and arguing about it. He was like, well, give me some. I'm like, look, you're an alcoholic. I'm not. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. So you keep the drinking, and I'll do this and drink with you. But he wanted something. I was like, no. No, you can't have none. But I tell you, we went in there, and they had all the alcohol that wasn't out when we stopped drinking and drug stuff I'd never seen before or heard of, and I was just, and I don't know. I like the way Chuck describes it. It wasn't my thought, but when he described it that way, I guess I felt the same way. It wasn't a thought to drink it, and it wasn't a thought not to drink it. I was so removed from the program that we was on this cruise. It was like fantasy world. It was like, you know, we've never done this before. It was exciting. It was fun, you know, and I don't know. I don't know if we ordered a drink or did we just go get a drink. I can't remember. It was music playing, and it was just, we was just in a good place. So we thought. And I remember when we got off of that cruise, before we got off the cruise, I mean, because after that, it was on. Now we go on gambling. You know, when you play the slot machines, they feed you alcohol. So now we're getting free alcohol. You know, we ain't even buying it, you know. And we just having a good old time. I don't know where my family was, but we wasn't with them. And we got off of that. We was getting off of that boat. And I remember saying to Chuck, we done really screwed up this time. And he said, D, and I'm serious. He said this, y'all. We didn't make this up. He said, D, what goes on a ship stays on a ship. And I believed him. I was like, okay. And we got off of that ship, you know, and went on about our business. And all hell broke loose because, you know, what went on that ship did not stay on the ship. And I don't know how soon. I didn't know Chuck was drinking. But he was, and I just remember, you know, things just starting to go downhill, you know. But things were still happening. We sold our house. I remember us drinking some wine over the cellar of the house. We were celebrating, you know. And I was raising my grandson at the time, and I remember him. He was telling me about this guy on his job who could get me some, you know, weed. And I said, he trying to set me up. This is what I was thinking to myself. And my grandson was gone out of town, so I decided I was going to do that. You know, I did not go to my main, the drug that got me into the rooms. I never went back to that. But I drank with him. Even though I ain't like it, I drank with him. I'm like, damn, if he gonna get high, I can't get high. So we got high together. And then I did my other stuff. Shortly thereafter, you know, this is his story, but it's part of my story too. He had to go some places and, you know, it just didn't pan out. And By the time we had built this house out here, and I don't know why in the world we ended up in Culpeper. To this day, I do not know why. I was just looking for some property to build a house, and there was some property out in Culpeper. We don't know nobody out here, you know. We just moved to Culpeper, you know, because that's where we was just going to move to Culpeper and build this big, beautiful home, and we're going to live happily ever after, and it didn't turn out that way. Things started losing things, and the bills came in, and you know, y'all remember when we got here, we were broke, busted, and disgusted. And, you know, I remember Chuck telling me one day, he said, "Dee, I'm going back to meeting." And I said, "Well, go ahead, because you need it." Because I didn't need it. Because I didn't relapse on my drug. I can take it or leave it, you know. And he said, "Well, you know what they're going to say." And I said, "What they're going to say, Chuck?" He said, "The first thing they tell you in AA, remove yourself from those people, places, and things." I was so mad with him. I was mad. I cussed him out. And I went upstairs. I was bawling. And I knew he was right. That's why. I knew he was right. And so that's why we have the same anniversary date. And I thank God for him now, because I don't know where I would be right now. So we came in and programmed together, and I don't know, when I first came around, I was expecting what I got the first time around, and I didn't. And I remember complaining to him in the car, and he said, because I was complaining to him that the women weren't reaching out like they did when I got sober the first time. And he said, "Well, why don't you reach out to them?" I was like, "Oh, what a concept. I guess I should." You see, y'all are supposed to come to me and welcome me. Don't y'all see I'm only black woman in the room? And he was like, "Dude, it don't work like that." And so now, because I'm extreme, so now I come to the meetings after that conversation. And I'm going up to every woman in the room. "Welcome. Good to see you. How you doing?" And that's how I started building my relationships with the females in Culpeper. I still try to do that. I'm not as good as I could be, but I do try to make people feel welcome, because I know how it feels when you're not felt or you don't feel welcome. You know, I wish Monique was here, because Monique used to come to the meeting and leave right away. And one day I said to her, "I'm not going to let her leave today." And she went walking out the door. I said, ma'am. I went running after her. I was like, "Give me a hug." You know, so I'll do stuff like that. But anyway, what it was like, what it is today, is at some point when I first started coming back around, I really wanted what you guys had. I wish I could say I came crawling back in. I was miserable, and I wasn't. I came back in because Chuck came back in. I was scared we wasn't going to be together if I kept drinking and drugging, and he got sober. That's why I came back in. That's the truth. But once I got here, I realized, you know, that I had a second chance at life. And so I got me a sponsor, whom I love and adore, but I didn't love and adore then. I thought, this woman is the one for me, because she going to tell me exactly what I need to hear. She ain't going to sugarcoat it. She ain't going to pat me on my back. You know, "It's going to be okay, Dee." Nope, she's not going to give me any of that. That's why I chose her, and I'm so glad I did, because she's been my rock since I've been here. She carried me through my steps. Matter of fact, she said, "Dee, next Saturday at such and such a time, we're doing your fifth step. It wasn't a can you or will you, it's we're gonna. And that's what we did. I started going to the Saturday morning meeting because Chuck was outgrowing me. He came home and started telling me some things. I started seeing a change in him. And I was like, now we got the same amount of time. I can't let him outgrow me. I got to stay up with him. So that's why I'm being honest. That's why I start coming to the 7 a.m. meeting. But I'm glad I did. Thank you, Chuck. But today I sponsor women. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I do work the steps of this program. I go to the Saturday 7 a.m. any length group called Pepper Virginia. Y'all should come and check it out. It's the best meeting in town. I'm sorry. That's not even my home group, but every time they say home group members raise their hand, I raise my hand because it is my home group. They just don't know it. But my home group is the Culpeper Hospital meeting every Thursday night at 7:30. I've been going there for the last 12 years. It's a beginner's meeting. I believe that that keeps me humble and keeps me reminded of where I come from, so I don't have these thoughts in my head that I've gotten this thing. I'm scared to relapse. It's a healthy fear. But I know if I do what I did today, tomorrow, I have a good chance of staying sober. It's been the best 12 years of my whole life. I can accept things today, and it's okay that I'm not where I want to be, but thank God I'm not where I used to be. I have a great job. I have a great husband. I have a beautiful home, and I can still... not be, a liar, cheating, thief. You know what I'm saying? I can have those things and still be a good person, and that's what I'm doing today. I just want to leave with this. I don't know if y'all know Joel Osteen. I'm not going to take credit for his little joke. But he said it was this little boy, his grandson, it was his grandfather, his grandson, and a donkey. And the grandson was riding the donkey, and they were going to town. And the grandfather was walking next to him. And somebody rode down the street and said, look at that little boy. He ought to be ashamed of himself, got his grandfather walking. So next thing you know, another person rode down the street, and the grandfather was riding a donkey. And the grandson was walking the donkey with his grandfather. And somebody said, that old man ought to be ashamed of himself. He riding the donkey and the little boy walking. Next person rode by, the grandfather and the grandson was carrying the donkey. Perception. There's a little book. I can't remember the name of that little book right now, but... it says, please everybody, nobody's pleased. Please yourself, at least you please. And then I got this one last thing. And I truly do try to live by this today. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt. Prior to investigation. Thank you.
I'm Richard Alcoholic. I want to thank Dee again for coming up here and everybody that come with her. That was a real good talk. Thank you, Dee.